Welcome to this Times Live Twitter Spaces event for the next 60 minutes. My name is Eusebius McKaiser. I'm a contributor and an analyst for Times Live. I'm also joined in this conversation by my colleague, veteran investigative journalist, Thandiqolo Jika, who is someone that has covered, the state capture story for many years now at various media, but him and I finally work in the same company, and his work you often read in the Sunday Times. And of course, many issues we don't get to, you'll also be able to pick up some of his content by going to timeslive.co.za. A couple of rules and what we're going to do. Look, the most important thing is that I want you to be A, patient, and B, forgiving, which are things that don't happen on Twitter because I've never hosted before. So really, the next 60 minutes is just us experimenting. If it doesn't work, tough luck, then we won't do it again. If you love it, we will, and you can tweet us suggestions, DM topics, tell us from a format point of view what you think we should do differently. All I know is TV and radio, and I was trying to think what I like about Twitter Spaces, what I don't like. I think they drag too much. I therefore told my team we will strictly make this 60 minutes like an open line conversation and see whether that works. Also, I'd like your interventions to be fast-paced. Brian, think of your question or your comment before you speak so that you don't waste too much time. Obviously, I in turn will be patient. Not everyone is a trained public speaker. I accept that. And then last, most importantly, which is also anti-Twitter and anti-Elon Musk, there are certain kinds of content that I do not tolerate. Hate speech, bigotry, ad hominem attacks. Please, none of that. Please make sure that you give us a crisp comment, top-down communication. And as I always used to say and still say, you're entitled to be heard. You're not entitled to have your worldview affirmed. We're going to be debating whether part four of the Zondo Commission is pointless or whether it takes us closer to justice. And I want you to make argument more than just giving us bile.
You're listening to Eusebius on Times Live. That's this latest podcast on Times Live. And it's me, Eusebius McKaiser, exploring the major issues of the week. That means you're going to hear a lot of law, politics, and ethics, how they intersect, and how important these stories are in the life of all South Africans.
When people zoll,
their children must know these are sellouts.
They put saliva on the paper.
Mr. Julius Malema whispered and said, sing it, sing it.
And then they share that zone.
No, I'm not going to apologize.
Can I have my iPad, please? So they stole it.
Let's get straight into it. Thandiqolo, thanks so much for being part of the conversation. Look, I think I was trying to determine what would be most helpful to the country in this conversation that's different to what they would have heard in another Twitter Spaces or what they might have read. And I think that would be to ask, what is the significance of part four? Where to from here? However, we can't answer those questions, as sexy as they are, until we do some absolute foundational setting of the scene in terms of what are the highlights in terms of what is actually in the report. So just give us a broad overview thematically of what part four covers, what stands out for you.
Thanks, Eusebius. Part four came out, it's confirmations of the many stories and the many things that we had written, you know, before. I'm talking about 8 years, 9 years ago regarding state capture. First of all, I mean, you look at, you know, the fact that where was the ANC in all of this? It also speaks about how the ANC failed the citizens of this country in defending the constitution and the wealth of the country. It also, I mean, for me, shows how we are left with bleeding state-owned entities because monies that were looted from these state-owned entities, left them bankrupt. We've got Eskom that is struggling. We've got the passenger rail of South Africa that is struggling. We've got Transnet that is struggling. And these are the results of state capture. And of course, I mean, you talk about other government departments, such as the Department of Human Settlements in the Free State, the Free State government, in fact, as a whole, and how the failed asbestos project, the failed housing projects, which were actually used to loot taxpayers' money, and those monies ended up in those politically connected elite, who were part of a certain faction. And also, what is very important when it comes to this report, the role of former President Jacob Zuma, you know, who has constantly said, "Ngenzeni, you know, what have I done? Please show me what have I done." Well, the report actually, you know, shows in chronology how President Zuma, in fact, let the Guptas run the country in appointing ministers. And those ministers that dared to challenge the Guptas were removed. Jacob Zuma's sword had befallen them. And, you know, I remember one of the stories we actually wrote back then, I think it was in 2014, Mcebisi Jonas being offered, he was then the deputy finance minister, being offered the finance minister job by the Guptas in Sachsenwald, and of course they offered him money at that time. After we published that story, how the ANC actually attacked the Sunday Times at that time, the spokesperson was Zizi Kodwa, and then said that we were writing gossip masquerading as news. So this report is important also in that context to show that the ANC as well was in fact defending the Guptas, and that the citizens of this country are the biggest losers in the whole situation, because we still have Eskom problems, yeah. Very big problems. It was an economic sabotage, in my view, most importantly, because the citizens of this country never actually benefited from anything in those years. The state-owned entities have collapsed.
So there's a couple of those stories I just want to detail before we ask the question, what does it all mean? And where to from here? Let's take the Free State one that you've referenced, for example. I mean, what is the opportunity cost of corruption? What scale are we talking about here? And how forensic was state capture report in terms of the level of specificity of the individuals involved that benefited illegally? What is the quality of the data that can be handed over to the NPA to begin the next part of the work, Tandukolo?
At least, you know, now the NPA did, in fact, start early with the asbestos case, because there was a lot of forensic investigation and work that had been done and handed over to them. And we are seeing those people appearing in court at this stage. We're talking billions of taxpayers' money. And we know that there was a system which in the criminal world and in law, it's called layering, where monies would come from government department and go into Saudi's companies, and then the money would go into different other parts of South Africa to different companies. People that did not actually do any kind of work in the asbestos situation. And having had some interactions with the NPA, and of course they say, listen, and we know people want us to take action immediately. But in law, it is not what you know. It is what you can prove. And they've... to a certain extent, yes, the Zondo report is some kind of guidance, but there are documents that were shared with the Zondo Commission that are already sitting with the ID. So there is in fact movement in terms of that. But there are also other difficulties that Zondo could not get into. For example, there's a story in the Sunday Times. I think it was written by my colleague Mawande. There's a constant reference seen in many payments from Saudi, which is AM. And Zondo could not, Chief Justice Zondo could not come to a conclusion who this AM was, who got about 10 million rand, which clearly that money was in cash. You know, people have been suspecting, and there were suspicions that AM could be standing for Esma Khashule. The NPA can work with that. The NPA will have to prove beyond any reasonable doubt that, you know, this AM is so and so. And then you've got also another enabler in the form of Musebenzi Zwane when he was there as the MEC of agriculture as well. You know, he allowed the Guptas to do whatever they pleased. Today, we are talking about Free State farmers who were left in the dairy farm with nothing. The Guptas took the money. We do not know to what level did Musebenzi Zwane get any form of kickback or so.
Okay. If you've just joined us, thanks so much for coming to our first Times Live Twitter space. I'm Eusebius McKaiser. I'm a contributor and analyst for Times Live. Many of you keep asking me my least favorite question, when are you coming back to radio? It's not the only medium, guys. The cool thing about new technology is that there are many fora where you and I can engage. Most of my journalism now lives on timeslive.co.za, and Times Live is also hosting this podcast series called Eusebius on Times Live, which I also hope many of you will subscribe to. I want to move on to one more theme before we ask the big picture questions, Tandukolo. One other theme that's dominant, and there's just so much here that we probably need a series of spaces conversations. And there are many others who are doing good work in that regard. Rivonia Circle have been doing it. I see Songezo here last night. Henny and his team did a fantastic spaces conversation. So there are many multiple conversations to be had so that we can collate all of the data and extrapolate the various issues that you can't do justice to in one conversation. We have got to talk about Eskom, Tandukolo. There is probably the single biggest issue that all South Africans agree on right now is that energy insecurity is A, something that makes us all hurtful. I have suddenly expanded my vocab by using far more swear words than I normally do. And it is bad for the economy. There's nothing worse for an economy than an unpredictable price sort of evolution of the cost of energy. And that's quite apart from not having energy security per se. And we've got both of those. You don't know for how long you will have energy supply, and you don't know what will happen to the cost of it in the years ahead. If you want to set up a smelter plant right now, and you've got to choose between South Africa and some other market in the global south, I would say, if I was being asked a private view as a consultant and not being patriotic, don't come to South Africa. We can't guarantee a regulatory environment in which you'll be able to have guaranteed major input in your processes, which is electricity or energy that you need in order to do what you need to do. This report, part four, is crucial because it helps us to begin to understand how Eskom was hollowed out. What happened?
Look, rightfully so, Eusebius, you've pointed quite a very important point. Nowhere in the world can a country survive, can a country's economy survive without power. You know, there needs to be reliable energy, and simply we don't have that currently. I mean, we've seen this happening, you know, in other parts of our continent, Nigeria, where there's just not, there's no reliable energy. And in this instance, what we see is how Eskom was consistently being stripped apart for the benefit of a few individuals. and how the introduction of different ministers at public enterprises was a way to pave the way for unprecedented looting, and to actually not to focus on supplying energy to the country, but just panel beat things now and then so that we have a bit of reliability. Yes, of course, somebody will argue and say, but no, the issue of Eskom power problems did not start with state capture, did not start with Brian Molefe and Coco Machela and Lynn Brown, etc. But the problem is that they exacerbated a situation in Eskom. Which is where you see that when Lynn Brown is now appointed as Minister of Public Enterprises, she actually circumvents processes of appointing people into boards. We see people, which is where Zondo becomes very important. We see people that are being suggested by a Gupta lieutenant, Salim Essa, being appointed into Eskom board. We see Brian Molefe and Anoj Singh, who had already managed to establish some kind of a scheme at Transnet that allowed the Guptas and their associates to be able to milk state coffers. They are then taken from Transnet and moved to Eskom, and it then continues. And there is this big drive to get Glencore to sell their mine to the Guptas. Now you've got people in the board who are singing to the Guptas. You've got a minister who in the Zondo Commission denied ever actually speaking to Salim Essa or knowing Salim Essa, but telephone conversation actually proved that Lynn Brown was actually having conversations with Salim Essa, and the people that Salim Essa was suggesting to be appointed into the board and to and into a number of the subcommittees at Eskom were actually indeed appointed and were doing the bidding of the Guptas. The likes of Mark Pamensky, for example. Mark Pamensky shared directorship or ownership of companies with Salim Essa. And Mark Pamensky was actually giving inside information to the Guptas. There are other people. I mean, there is there's evidence which now Zondo actually proves that confidential Eskom information was in fact being shared with the Guptas using some a funny email info portal something which he says belonged to Salim Essa. So there was never any more any focus on fixing Eskom problems, the energy problems that we were facing at the time, but it was about the looting that had already started at Transnet, that had already started in other state-owned entities. It moved into Eskom. As a result, Eskom was stripped to such an extent that we today find ourselves in a situation where government cannot guarantee reliable energy. Entrepreneurs, young people that are being encouraged to start businesses, etc., they're simply struggling in this country because there is no reliable energy. They can't drive their businesses. We constantly talk about that, you know, this affects investors. Investors are going to flee. It is not only about the investors. Yeah. It is about the people in the country. Can they sustain themselves in the face of high unemployment? They can't because there's no reliable energy.
100%. Accountability is important. It's really important for me that many of these ministers be shamed. There needs to be legal accountability. There needs to be political accountability. You know, whenever you say Lynn Brown, this is the first thing that comes to mind is this song. I can't, even when I was reading the reports, I'm taken back to my childhood and I think of Pinocchio. And the reason is that she's such a bloody liar. Her nose, and that's why I call her Lynn Brown nose, not Lynn Brown, must grow every time she speaks. Whenever I had her on my radio show on 702, I used to feel embarrassed on her behalf, her friends' behalf, her family's behalf. And I think to myself, my goodness, you are beyond shame. And I want to also hold us accountable in the media, including the Sunday Times, myself being part of Arena. We've got, and I'm looking at it right now, Thando Tolo, the lead story on Sunday. Where was the ANC? You are one of three authors of the lead story. And most of it quotes one Pravin Gordhan. And basically, he's moralizing about the importance of justice and accountability, and we really must go after the people who captured the state. And I'm thinking two things to myself, Thando Tolo, as a South African, quite apart from being an analyst. The first thing I think about is how. Why are we in the media treating this man as if he shouldn't be held accountable as part of the ANC collective? And number two, he himself should self-examine the role qua political party of the African National Congress in the making of Jacob Zuma. Jacob Zuma wasn't a lone ranger, a sugar daddy that was just there in jail by himself. He was sponsored by the likes of Pravin Gordhan, the rest of the executive keeping quiet, and dare I say it, his deputy who became president, Cyril Ramaphosa. And so how do you feel about that, both as a journalist and also as a senior journalist in the country and as a South African? I mean, we have this tendency of dividing the ANC between the constitutionalists, who are the good guys, versus the bad guys from the so-called nine wasted years. But there's only just one ANC, and they're all collectively responsible.
In my view, Eusebius, like I've said even before, you know, here there are no angels and demons in that ANC. The ANC itself, including Pravin Gordhan, like you've rightfully pointed out, they were part of the ANC that created the environment that led to the capturing of the state. They did not hold each other accountable. They never actually did hold each other accountable. Instead, they consistently defended each other and the ANC. And then they got to a point where they then started creating, they've been there, but started talking about factions and trying to create this impression to South Africans that there's angels and demons in the ANC. But that is absolutely not true. And one would see in the rise of former President Jacob Zuma, who comes into the space, and these things happen under him. That is fine. That then happens. But the ANC never actually takes any serious action against one of their fellow comrades. I'll give you an example. Mosebenzi Zwane is sort of promoted or whatever. He's the chairperson of Transport Portfolio Committee in Parliament. Despite all the things that Mosebenzi Zwane did as a minister of DMR and also as an MEC in the Free State, no action was taken by the ANC. He was never held accountable. So there is no culture within the ANC of holding the other accountable. Instead, they create factions, and we have to choose amongst those worst people that, you know, we select to be people who lead us in the country. The state capture shows us to such an extent that ANC was idling, sitting there, and as long as a number of people were still contributing to the ANC with government money. Well, because the major problem is that the ANC turned a blind eye because it was receiving donations from the companies doing business with the state. Absolutely. So the ANC in totality, it is actually part of the problem.
There's another big theme for me that I want us to explore that I think is important as we step back from the minutiae. And that is the role, Thando Tolo, of the private sector, which is really important. Yes, state capture, by its very definition, and in terms of the terms of reference, is about the state. But as Harry Nell said to me at a conference many years ago when I interviewed him, It takes two to tango. For state capture to happen, you invariably need someone corruptible within the state to be in cahoots with someone in the private sector that then sets up that corrupt nexus between the private sector and the state. What bothers me about the report is that it is not treating with sufficient parity the wrong in the private sector that the private sector enables with their toxic relationship with certain officials within the state. Let's take the example of McKinsey. And I'm working on an analysis piece about McKinsey for next week that I'll file for Times Live at some point. And I've already got my preliminary first sentence, which will be, Justice Zondo let McKinsey off the hook. And I tell you why I think this, and I want your reflection and everyone else's reflection back. Because what McKinsey does, which Bain didn't do, was to try and make the PR go away preemptively by saying, we'll pay R1 billion or whatever. And then they come across, with the help of Alexander Weiss, as if they are unwitting victims of Figaz Sagar, one of the partners who've subsequently left before being DC'd internally at McKinsey, and he's now in London. And McKinsey can now drive a wedge between itself as a company and the Lone Ranger, bad individual senior partner in the firm. And life goes on. And we talk about Trillium. We talk about Eskom. We splash the faces of the board members from the 2014 board in our newspapers. But no one talks about the economic sabotage, as you rightly called it earlier, that should be attached to the name of McKinsey. The report never says McKinsey is culpable. McKinsey played a role in state capture. McKinsey should be barred. And most importantly, for the maths guys in the room, the total economic cost of contributing to blackouts during that period is far more than R1 billion. R1 billion is probably an underdetermination of the total cost of McKinsey getting an unlawful contract with Eskom. And that kind of malfeasance in the private sector, I think, doesn't get sufficient prominence in the report. I don't know whether you agree with me or whether you think I'm being harsh on McKinsey.
So, I mean, from the first report, Zondo touched on McKinsey and Bain, their role, et cetera, et cetera. But you're quite right that we have not, even including us in the media, splashed the faces of the people at McKinsey, in our pages, to show that these were the individuals who are alleged to have been corrupt and actually involved in corrupt activities, the Sagars, etc. But what is important for me when it comes to the issue of McKinsey and Bain, etc., it's a lot of money. It's more than R1 billion, right? This is where, for me, our law enforcement comes into place. I'm talking about SARS and the Hawks and the NPA. This is when they should be going after recovery of monies. They've done that to a certain extent when it comes to regiments, etc. You know, they should be recovering monies owed to the taxpayers of this country, and then also follow up with criminal prosecutions. The reason I'm arguing that they should recover monies stolen from the taxpayers, that comes back, that money should come back to the fiscus and help us out in the economy. There shouldn't only be just a criminal prosecution and the person goes to jail and that's it. But for you to prevent these things happening in the future, you have to have harsher consequences for people. People need to think twice. If they're going to commit such crimes, the state will recover money from you, from individuals, not only the company, the individual directors involved in these transactions. That should be done, and not only focus on charging them criminally. And that could perhaps help us, deter people from engaging in corrupt activities. That was not happening because, of course, our law enforcement agencies had also been captured and they had been destroyed to the core.
Do you agree with my basic intuition and Tandu Tolos that the private sector needs a fuller description of their role in state capture? Obviously, the State Capture Commission has got well-defined terms of reference and won't be the final word. Also, what it says and recommends doesn't prevent the NPA vis-a-vis its own constitutional and statutory powers to initiate investigations that it can and must do so at any rate. So we in turn need to hold the NPA accountable. The NPA is not restricted to only take its cue from what the Zondo Commission actually finds. And I think it's important to bear that in mind. There's another example I want us to touch on, though, Tandu Tolo, which is besides the big question of how consulting firms need to have their role in economic sabotage properly articulated and economic justice needs to be debated, I think it's to be about more than just repaying the nominal value of the contract, because the real impact is far worse than that. But what about also the financial institutions like the banks? They don't only facilitate illicit moving of money in and out of the country. They do so in part because they also have an incentive when they benefit from the banking charges and the transactional fees that are paid when these huge amounts of illicit trading happens within the banking sector. And so for me, the role of our banks, banks like Nedbank, for example, also needs to be a contender for the front page as much as a Machela Koko or a Anosh Singh would be a contender to have their faces splashed. We don't have household names in this country being the names of the CEOs, for example, of those who work within the financial sector. And yet the financial sector and the banks specifically are also very important parts of the overall story, aren't they?
Absolutely, Yubi. The banks, didn't have to wait for things to get worse. They saw these transactions. Many of them saw these transactions, especially when we're talking about Nedbank, right? They allowed these suspicious transactions to continue, et cetera, et cetera. But there were a number of forensic investigations, particularly by the National Treasury, which raised a lot of red flags about the Gupta companies. And that, for me, should have alerted the banks that they should be looking at the accounts of these companies. That should have alerted SARS that, of course, SARS could not do anything because it had also now been captured and somebody been placed there. But anyway, in my view, they should be held accountable. Nedbank should be held quite accountable, and I agree with you. They should be in the front pages as well as enablers of state capture. There's many enablers of state capture. It is not only President Jacob Zuma. It is not only the ANC. The private sector actively played a role and did not say no, because they were also benefiting from these transactions. And I believe that there should be monies that should be recovered from the likes of Nedbank.
The pithy question is, part four, is it utterly pointless or does it bring us closer to justice? And I am in conversation with my colleague, who's an investigative journalist with Sunday Times, Tandu Tolo Jika, who has covered state capture for many years. And the issues are wide and they are also very, very deep. Let's talk a little bit about systems analysis. Again, we can't expect Zondo to do everything, but it is important for me, Tandu Tolo, that we don't get bogged down only in the individual protagonists or play example table tennis, where you go, here is EOH, and you speak about it for 50 pages. Here is what happened at the New Age, and you speak about it for 50 pages. I'm hoping that the final installment will be the biggest one yet, and that it will have better systemic and institutional analyses than the versions that we've had so far, where it's really been a data dump about particular sites within the state that had been looted. And what do I mean by that? What I mean by this is, for example, understanding the difference between corruption and state capture. They're two different concepts. Understanding the modus operandi so that we can understand how these institutions were repurposed, like Treasury, so that the hyenas can steal into perpetuity. Because if we don't understand the methodology of state capture, if we don't understand how the institutions had been repurposed, then you can put Zuma and his friends in orange overalls, but those institutions will remain vulnerable to the next generation of thieves, won't they?
I agree with you there. You know, there was a systematic breakdown. Even, you know, I actually liked some of the recommendations from Zondo, you know, because it said to me he was considering that there was a systematic breakdown of government entities, government itself, etc. In that, you know, he recommended, for example, there needs to be a new way of appointing board members. It should not be, you know, a matter of a minister deciding on who should be a board member, etc. I mean, the way we appoint board members in this country is actually ridiculous. We appoint people into a space like an energy space. But this person has got what? A communications background, et cetera, et cetera. They understand absolutely nothing there. At PRASA, as we speak currently, we've got people there in that board who know nothing about trains or anything with engineering. So I like some of Zondo's recommendations when it comes to a change in terms of the system and how we do things. And also, he spoke a lot as well about this issue of donations, which is a very big problem that also enables corruption. That, you know, somebody gets a contract at the city of Joburg, and then they must also donate to the gala dinner of the ANC. That is part of corruption. That is how corruption actually thrives. Because I, as Thandukolo Jika, who owns this company, in order for me to get a contract from government, I need to convince somebody at Luthuli House that I'm actually going to give you to give Luthuli House 10%. Those are the systematic breakdowns that are causing the problems, and rightfully so. You can appoint whoever you want to appoint as the president of this country. As long as we have those type of things happening, we're still going to have the same problem. I mean, we got currently President Ramaphosa here, caught on tape talking about that he knows that you know, comrades were taking money from the state for ANC matters. You know, but he does nothing about that. He does not open a case. He does not go, absolutely nothing happens. He does not go open a case. Like, they don't hold each other accountable. We cannot trust politicians in any manner. So for me, a systematic overhaul and things to be done in a different way, you know, the 10% issue for me is one of the biggest problems. And this is how the private companies have actually captured the state. Victims of all of this, the victims of all of this are actually the middle class and the very poor people of this country. 100%. Because monies are exchanging hands between the private individuals, the politicians, the politically connected individuals, drive fancy cars, wear expensive suits, like Malusi Kikaba, enjoys Dubai trips, etc. You know, that's where the problem is. There needs to be a systematic overhaul. And I mean, we've got a number of individuals in this country who are working hard in holding the state accountable. And I think that what is we need to talk about,
but yeah, maybe it will be a topic for another either podcast edition, Paige, who's sitting here with me, my producer, or for a second spaces in the next couple of weeks. What does accountability actually mean? And can we reimagine a South Africa where we are less reliable on the body politic? I think those are actually good topics to tackle, hey, Paige? And we'll keep that
Absolutely.
In mind. I'll write it down and we'll come back to that. Okay, so some of you are tweeting. You can tweet and just tag at Eusebius or at Times Live. Alternatively, or in addition, use the hashtag #DebatingZondo Part 4. And 4 is the number 4. Got one comment here from Ayanda who tweeted, I think that people are tired, Eusebius, and we have just lost patience with our institutions, politicians and our legal team. I hope that we will get justice and accountability from all involved, but I just don't have faith, she says. Then Dr. Leshlohonolo Makake does not speak kak when he tweets. Thanks for a mind-blowing discussion. Thank you for your generosity, sir. Thanks to your team and to Prologica. I think that's important. And our colleagues elsewhere, media, News 24, many other places, also institutions of research, collectively, they work was the basis, really, for this eventually becoming this kind of inquiry. But he says, my concern is the following, nevertheless. Will there be any criminal investigations? I think he says, just lost that there. But will there be any criminal sort of investigations that will be coming after this? A last read that comes through, someone said a little bit earlier, well, we know nothing will happen. Why should we waste our breath? And, you know, this is actually a really interesting issue, kind of, Tolo, because from all the sort of politics seminar language that we are using around accountability, et cetera, what Ayanda's tweet and the last one that I mentioned brings out is something that I have been told, that I spoke to analyst Ebrahim Fakir about on Eusebius and Times Live 3 weeks ago, which is that there's a decline in levels of trust in the average citizen in relation to political parties specifically. And in addition to that, of course, we now know that although still reasonably high by international standards, if we take 94 as a baseline, there is a steady over time decline in electoral participation of South African voters. Put simply, we are becoming cynical about politics, and that bodes poorly for democracy overall.
And it is quite understandable, Eusebius. You know, and that comes from seeing from citizens and ordinary people seeing that amasela are not being, you know, sent to jail. Nobody is being prosecuted. Nobody. It is based on the fact that people have seen no action, and that the result of that has been years of capture of our law enforcement agencies. There is a very interesting affidavit submitted by advocate Karen van Rensburg in the Zondo Commission about how the NPA was actually captured. And she mentions, it's a very long affidavit, but she mentions how the system was being broken down and who the enablers were. So ordinary South Africans have a right to feel the way they are feeling and have no confidence in any politician.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there's a, as you heard me say that, Paige, there was a really interesting comment that came through. Let me see if I can find it again. Also from Ayanda, which is related to the cynicism issue. And I think it's important because this now takes us to a question of what kind of political culture state capture has engendered. Ayanda says, Pravin Gordhan was asking us to not call them thugs. Yet they are the ones that have said by, while they know for a fact that state money is being used for party affairs. We've all heard the audio that Tanitolo is speaking about. But you know what's interesting about this, Tanitolo, is that when I read your work and your, our colleagues' work in the Sunday Times and across the rest of the media, then I think to myself, what can I infer about the nature of the South African state? And Pravin wants to get annoyed when a word like thug gets used because it's got connotations of criminality, anti-constitutionalism. Maybe it analogizes to, for example, being a gangster on the Cape Flats. But the concept of a gangster state is actually a serious concept in political theory. And you need to ask yourself, what are the red flags of a democratic state that is slowly morphing into a gangster state? And when you have a party that is the incumbent governing party, that is not just a beneficiary, but as you said earlier, it is blind because it is willfully blind because it is benefiting from state capture, like people having to pay a lot of money when they come and sit next to the president at a party political event, knowing that they will get a return on the investment. There is thuggery. There is a South African state that is becoming a predatory state. And so I think Ayanda, our reader, is spot on, and I don't know whether you would agree, that the way we characterize the consequence of what it is that you report on is that it's nothing short of the South African democratic state becoming a gangster state, and we need to take that seriously. It's not just a colloquial description. It is actually a seriously analytical point.
That's absolutely true, and that is backed up, you know, by a lot of evidence in terms of, you know, how the ANC conducted itself when it comes down to law enforcement. In order for you to reach a level of a gangster state, the first thing that you do, you make sure that your law enforcement agency is crippled. You put in place people who have no interest of upholding the constitution of this country. As we speak, in this country, we've never had a national director of public prosecution who finished their term, the 10-year term. And what is that? It has only been because of political meddling. And that is very key. If ANC indeed believed in law, why have we had such a fight over who holds the position of NDPP? And why has nobody
actually... Absolutely. I think you're right. And that's because the entire value chain, that entire value chain of justice itself had been hollowed out.
And this, you know, you go back, Eusebius, you know, how even in Parliament, in those in the early portfolio committees that they used to have, where they had the Andrew Feinsteins and them, when initially MPs were caught out, you know, with their hands in the cookie jar, abusing state resources, right? The ANC was fine with that until those portfolio committees started really performing their work and it came to the arms deal. That then turned everything upside down and the ANC focused on the law enforcement and everything started to break down. I'm talking about organized crime unit. I'm talking about the Scorpions themselves. The crime intelligence in this country is absolutely in tatters. And crime intelligence has been proven in other reports, in fact, that crime intelligence crime intelligence and state security agency were serving political factions. Of the ANC. That is how you arrive at a gangster state, where 100%. The state institution, law enforcement, is broken down to a point where they become private armies of politicians.
Okay, we are wrapping it. We literally have 5 minutes left. I'm having so much fun. I do wish it was 2 hours. Please also DM me for examples of other topics you want us to cover. Who you'd like me to be in conversation with, if they agree. A lot of people are still scared of the medium, but they might become used to it over time. So your recommendations are more than welcome. At Times Live or at Eusebius, we'll pick them up. We'll discuss it as a team. Let's do one last thing in the 4 minutes that are left, Tandikolo. Let's frame as experienced, I'm not saying old or veteran, experienced journals, what the questions are that are top of mind for us in our work and just as South Africans What are the kinds of questions you think we need to speak about over the water cooler this afternoon, over the braai, over the weekend? I'll go first, then you can have the final say, and we'll wrap it there.
Okay, cool.
So for me,
cool.
There's a cluster of questions. I won't mention them all. The first is, how can we reduce the power of politicians and political parties? I think countries the world over, societies the world over, need to grapple with that. It is an accident of history that political parties have got enormous power, including the ability to form government, create policy, have a monopoly on force, and therefore politicizing the security cluster like in South Africa. Us as quote-unquote ordinary citizens need to ask ourselves, what does it mean to live in a society in which politicians have less power, and then how do we get there? Secondly, we've got to ask ourselves, how do we strategically cooperate across our differences? Differences are okay. They too are an accident of history. They are language, class, political, ideological, racial, and other differences between us. Politicians and private sector interests that are in the Zondo Commission report love it when ordinary citizens are divided among themselves. Because when we are divided, there's greater opportunity for them to get away with murder. And we need to learn to better cooperate in terms of civil society. And so another question over the water cooler to puzzle through is, how do we strategically cooperate despite our differences in order to maximize that which we collectively have an interest in achieving as a country? What for you is in your notebook that you are chasing around the story, Tanditlolo? And what do you think is important that you can't write as a reporter, but from an opinion point of view, that you think matters?
For me, it's just one. You know, it has always been the fact that how do we, you know, get rid of this cancer called corruption in our society for the citizens of this country to benefit from the country's wealth, because that's what we are chasing. You know, with 1994 came this hope that, you know, things will change for the better, you know, for the majority of the black people of this country. But actually, things have been worse for them. And that has only been happening because of crass materialism, corruption, and to the lowest level, councillors, they don't care. And it is simply because of corruption that the citizens of this country are not enjoying the wealth of this country at all. The citizens of this country continue to struggle. So for me is, how do we deal decisively with corruption, effectively, which has crippled everything we've got in this country? I mean, currently, you know, with the disaster in KZN, everybody is expecting politicians and their friends to steal.
Absolutely.
And we've accepted that it cannot be.
No, absolutely. And I think we'll leave it there on that note, Tanditlolo. Thanks so much for coming into the Twitter spaces. Hundreds of people, I see, have managed to dip in and out of it over the last hour. I think it was a successful experiment to some extent. I'd have liked to have more of you actually on to speak and hear your voices per se. But your tweets are just voluminous. I will still engage during the course of the day. On my way to the barber, while sitting there, I'll read and engage you on Twitter. And that's the cool thing about multimedia platforms. We can engage a little bit later. But I think when all is said and done, the reality is that the rule of law is under threat. It can only be entrenched if actually the NPA does its job, take its cue from the Zondo Commission, does not allow itself to be constrained by the Zondo Commission, because it's got an independent mandate that is separate from the Zondo Commission. And then beyond that, a civil society, the best thing we can do for our country is to treat politicians as ordinary rather than as special. Thank you so much for tuning in.